Hello and welcome to the Unnamed Automotive Podcast. My name is Sammy Hadj Assad, and with me, as always, is my good friend and fellow automotive journalist, Benjamin Hunting. Say hi to the people, Ben.
Greetings, human listeners.
Greetings to everyone. If this is the first time you're listening to our podcast, thank you for trying something new. I will reiterate, Ben and I are a pair of automotive journalists, but more important than that, we're really good friends. Isn't that true, Ben?
That is accurate.
It's so accurate that I let Ben take complete control of the podcast for just a few minutes at the beginning of each episode so that he can plug all of the recent places he's contributed to. Ben, the talking stick is yours.
Why is it so warm and just uncomfortably warm, Sammy? Like, I told you, keep the talking stick away from the microwave.
Are you concerned about the... Like, there's no instructions on this that it needs to be in a cool, damp place.
So, when I was a kid...
Dark place.
My mom's father, my grandfather, maternal grandfather, he was a restaurateur. And he had a bunch of chicken restaurants and eventually branched out into bringing KFC to Canada. He was a part of that initial group back in the 60s. But I remember one of the restaurants had closed and we got one of the microwaves from the restaurant. And this is okay. In the 80s. And the microwave was seriously huge. Like, to give you an idea of how large this microwave was, it had cooking instructions for a full turkey on the door. Remember when microwaves came with cooking instructions for specific foods?
Yeah.
That were like, it wasn't in the manual, so they put it on the unit itself.
Yeah, yeah.
So all I'm saying is, I stood in front of that microwave a lot when I was a kid, and it was really powerful. Like, it would cook things much more quickly than any microwave I've ever used since. And I have the strong suspicion there were no regulations involved in the building of that microwave.
Okay.
So keep the stick out of the microwave, Sammy.
Got you. Will do. Do you want to tell people where to find some work that you've contributed to?
Well, all my work glows in the dark. And
yes, you can we understand now.
You can find it at Motor Trend, at Car and Driver, and at Inside Hook.
And you can find my work at autotrader.ca, driving.ca, and Nouveau magazine, as well as Electric Autonomy Canada. Ben, speaking of Electric Autonomy Canada, you've been driving a pretty cool EV, a pretty hot EV.
It's
as hot as the talking stick.
Hotter than the battery pack on last week's AMG EV, that's for sure.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's because couldn't get up to speed.
I couldn't get it up to speed. This EV had no problems giving me full power whenever I wanted it, which is, I think, when you're spending a lot of money on a high-performance electric vehicle. That's probably important, don't you think, Sammy?
Yeah, I think it's very important. Why not?
So I drove the 2024 BMW i5 M60. That's a bunch of numbers and words that together describe the electrified version of the redesigned 5 Series. Because what BMW is doing now, unlike Mercedes-Benz, which has separate chassis and platforms for their electric vehicles versus their standard cars. I mean, they do have some conversion cars, right, Sammy?
They have a couple, I think.
GLB, is I4. That a conversion?
Oh, no, sorry, Mercedes. Yeah, EQB.
Yeah, EQB.
And the GLB.
So those vehicles are conversions, and then they have their pure electrified cars. At BMW, they haven't really done that so much. There is a pure electric, if you look at the iX, which is its own platform, that SUV that we talked about last year. I got a chance to drive that. And it doesn't really share anything substantial. I believe there's some X5 in there, but it's not specifically an X5 platform. But BMW has, way back when they first started making electric cars, they made the i3. Which was its own platform. And then they made the i8, which was its own platform, but that was a plug-in hybrid, so not fully electric. And then they kind of went over to the conversion car world, where they made the i4, which was a 4 Series Grand Coupe with an electric drivetrain, and the i7, which is kind of, I wouldn't call it a conversion car, because that was the first point where we started to see BMW merging their product lines, where they would use this platform, and I can't remember the exact name of it. I think it's called like CLAR or something like that. Okay. And it's kind of like their version of Toyota's TNGA, which is like underpins everything.
Everything, yeah.
Yeah. But the platform that BMW developed was so they could make electric cars and gas-powered cars without having to have two separate product lines. So this has manifested itself in a couple of interesting ways with their standard vehicles. For the 5 Series, it's given them the chance to like mix the electric cars in with the gas cars and create, you know how we used to say that the best version of the X5 was the plug-in hybrid? Mm-hmm. And how if you look at the BMW X5 lineup, there's like the base model, and then there's the plug-in hybrid, and then there's the V8, and then there's the M5, the X5M. Well, okay. For the 5 series, they've done that, but with the EV. So you have the base model EV. There's two versions. There's a rear-wheel drive, and there's an all-wheel drive. Okay. And then you have the vehicle I drove, which is the M60. And then you will theoretically have the M5, which is coming out either later this year or early next year, and that's going to be a hybrid vehicle.
Just a standard hybrid, or do you think it's going to be a plug-in hybrid?
I don't know. I would think a standard hybrid because I don't know if they would want the weight of the plug-in hybrid.
I think they don't care about weight anymore.
Well, you might be very right about that based on what we'll talk about later with the M60.
Okay. But
the reason I think this is important is because this has allowed the M60 to not just slide into the regular 5 Series lineup and look exactly like the other 5 Series inside and out, mm-hmm. but it also displaces a 5 Series model that I don't think is going to come back, and that's the M550i, Sammy.
Now, that's important to bring up because both you and I have said that the M550i is like the normal person's M5. Like,
yeah.
It was as good as an M5 is without some of the added... First of all, the added price of an M5
and the pretense of track performance, right?
Right?
Like that's you don't need to pay for that. They're so close in a straight line, and yet so docile in regular driving. You're not really there's no penalty to be had like there is with the M5, where things can get really like it has all of those drivetrain settings and transmission settings, and it can get really complicated and weird.
Yeah.
And the M550 largely avoids most of that, but you also get a cool twin turbo V8 sound, which is a lot of fun. But Sammy, that car seems to be gone from BMW's lineup. It's just not there anymore. And then if you look at the numbers on the M and the M60, it's clear that they eclipse the M550, and yet it seems to be priced around relatively the same pricing point. It's like, I think, let me double check this number, but it's about $84,000.
$84,000 is where this car ends up.
It's where this car ends up.
Okay.
And that's in the US. In Canada, it's $98,000.
Interesting.
So if you want a base i5, which is also available, which I don't think displaces the M550, that's $67,000. So, and I don't know exactly how much the all-wheel drive version costs, but that's the price of entry for battery power in the 5 Series. But this car has 592 horsepower and 549 pound-feet of torque. And like that AMG I drove, it has a boost function, except unlike the AMG, I can access it whenever I want. I don't have to wait for the battery to warm up. Or maybe I do and it just gets warmer faster. And it's not just the battery boost on the AMG was only available for race start, which means you can only use it off the line. For the BMW, there's a little toggle on the steering wheel, and it gives you 10 seconds of boost. And that adds about, I want to say, 60 pound-feet of torque? 56 pound-feet, exactly, for 10 seconds.
Okay.
And those are huge numbers. That puts it over 600 pound-feet of torque.
That's crazy. That's huge. Is that where, maybe that's where the M60 part of this name comes from?
I mean, I don't know. 60, how so?
60K? 60 plus another zero?
No, it's like 605 horsepower.
I think. There you go. Okay, that sounds wild. Like 600 horsepower. First of all, like EVs.
592 horsepower.
EVs that deliver, let's say like 400 horsepower and like 400 torques or whatever you want to call it. Like they feel quick. They feel real quick and responsive.
Yeah.
To add another 200 horsepower to that must be intoxicating. Like, well, it must be wild.
Yes and no. This is also a vehicle that weighs 5,200 pounds.
Yeah, but everything weighs 5,200 pounds.
The M550 weighed 1,000 pounds less.
Holy, really?
Yes. So
okay.
So this is where the real differences start to crop up when you're looking at comparing these two cars. If you're really considering the M60 as a 550 replacement, in a straight line, it does 60 in like under 4 seconds. It was really quick, even with winter tires on it. But when you're driving it quickly through corners, et cetera, et cetera, you notice the weight. You definitely notice the weight. I mean, it's down low like it is on every EV these days with the battery pack down at the bottom of the chassis. But it's still a very heavy vehicle. So it's not necessarily as engaging as the M550 was. It's very, very good in a corner.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I would call it fun. I think it's just an extremely fast executive car That's probably the best descriptor of it. The other thing that's kind of strange is, so that boost function is scary. Like, I did use it on some highway on ramps. I used it to pass in some very tight areas. It's extremely easy to get up to like 110 miles an hour, which is like 170 kilometers an hour, and not even realize it. Because
you still feel you got more to go.
You've got way more to go, and the sensation of speed. I noticed in the AMG EQE, which I'm using as a comparator, even though it has more power and is more expensive, I think the performance is roughly equivalent. And the AMG was very twitchy. Like the accelerator pedal was extremely sensitive, and that made it difficult to drive around town. The i5 really smooths that out. It's quite a difference, to be honest. And I think that that's part of what makes the acceleration so deceptive. Like, if you really want to pin someone's neck, you can do it, but you have to work at it. Like, you're going to be brake boosting the start to do that. Okay. It has a top speed of 143 miles an hour, which feels low.
That
for the power it has, it might be tire limited. I don't know. But Sammy, you're going to like the fact that it has a Hans Zimmer soundtrack.
Of course I like that. Don't worry.
So when you are accelerating, maybe the reason I didn't notice the speed was because I was intoxicated by the enchanting sounds of Hans Zimmer at full throttle.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a possibility. Tell me more about this experience. I mean,
it doesn't make stupid sounds when you lock it or unlock it. How about that?
This poor EQE is getting, you know, it's getting raked across the coals here.
The EQE had the misfortune of being driven back-to-back against the M60, and this is a cheaper car that I think is just a better all-around package. First of all, it looks way better.
It looks so much better. I mean, the EQE looks like a jelly bean that was left out in the sun.
And this just looks like a 5 Series.
And that's great.
Yeah. If you're into that, you're going to love it. If you're not into it, it still looks pretty good.
Absolutely. I think that's an important starting point with these vehicles. What about the interiors? I mean, this doesn't have a gimmicky hyper screen.
It doesn't have a gimmicky hyper screen, which is optional on the EQE, which I had in my car. I'm not a big fan of it. I don't really feel it's necessary. I'm not a big fan.
A $10,000 option. We talked about $10,000 option.
That was on the Canadian car. I'm not a big fan of any feature that when the car is off transforms itself into a black slab of plastic. I think that's
the only feature.
I like detail. Yeah. I like detail in cars. And if you're giving over your entire dash to a screen, you lose a lot of real estate that you could have added detail to. I'm sorry. Right. It doesn't do it for me. BMW just has normal amount of screens, very normal interior. The strange thing is, it doesn't have a flat It doesn't have a flat floor because it shares that platform with the 5 Series with the gas motor. So there still has to be room for a drivetrain and drive shafts, even though the motors are in the axles for the electric version. Mm-hmm. The trunk is a little bit smaller, 1 cubic foot smaller. I was still able to put my largest cooler in the trunk upright and open it while it was inside the trunk. So it's very useful. Took it on a relatively long trip at temperatures that were above freezing, but not much above freezing. The car is advertised as having 256 miles on a single charge. I think that's like, what, 400 kilometers or something like that?
Okay.
And that's right in the middle of the pack for what you would want to see for any EV, I guess. Yeah, that's 410 kilometers. You can get a Hyundai that has more than that. If you get the base model rear-wheel drive i5, it gets, I think, 296 miles or something like that. So it's available. The distance is there if you want it, but if you're getting the M60, you're paying for that performance with range.
Right, right.
But the regeneration was really good. I was able to keep it honest in terms of its range and actually outperform it even in colder weather, which was something that I think wasn't as easy to do with the Mercedes. And I charged it at a couple of public stations. I saw between 65 and 75 kilowatts. One of them was a shared connection with the 65. The other one was a 150 kilowatt station. It was a cold morning. I couldn't get it to go above 75, 76. So that's not amazing, but I also didn't precondition the battery. And that probably would have made a difference.
No, I think you're right. That doesn't sound great, though, 65 and 75. Even on a cold day, I think we should be able to get
five. I do want to stress that that was shared and there was someone else using the other plug.
Interesting. Tell me more about the cabin. I mean, I know we keep saying that this is like standard BMW 5 Series fare, but I don't think I've even gotten close to a new 5 Series since it was unveiled.
Well, remember last week when you were talking about the drive modes on your X2?
Yeah, I remember. Don't worry.
And how all right. I mean, we're all concerned about your memory, Sammy.
Yeah.
I remember how we were talking about how it had like not necessarily drive modes, but they were just called modes.
Yeah.
What were they? Digital art.
Digital art was the one I remember. Yeah.
So the i5 has like multiple digital arts, and when you choose them, it gives you this wild background for your screens, and it also expands onto the lighting that goes along the side of the door panels and the dashboard, and they're kind of cool, but I don't really, you know, it's a gimmick. It's one of those BMW gimmicks that we were discussing.
Mm-hmm.
The other gimmicks that it has that air console you were talking about.
Okay.
So you can play video games if you want to.
Thank goodness.
I did not do that. The worst gimmick though, out of all of them, and this is, I think, a real problem with the vehicle. BMW has this assisted driving plus system. I think it's just called Assist Plus. And it's intended to be kind of like Super Cruise, where it's a hands-free driving system. It only works on certain roads, like Super Cruise, but the number of roads it works on is extremely tiny. Like, it's a much smaller subset of highways and whatnot. That's fine. I can understand that eventually you're going to roll out more roads over time. The real problem with it is it only works and it will only activate if you have a destination set in the factory navigation system.
Oh, so when you're using Android Auto or Apple CarPlay, it's not functional.
It's not functional.
Or that feature is just a dud.
Or when you're just driving without a destination in nav, it's not functional either. This is not how any of the other systems work. Hmm. You can use Super Cruise whenever you want on the highway. You turn it on, Super Cruise is on. You turn it off, yeah, it's off. It's not linked to another state in another system. I don't understand that. If that's a technical limitation, maybe you want to wait until you don't need that limitation before you roll out this feature, because it feels it puts the car at a disadvantage to its competitors. The other weird thing is that system, the Assist Plus, also allows you to change lanes by looking at the side view mirrors when a lane change is suggested by the system.
Oh, okay. That's some next level stuff. Okay.
I did not test this out because I am not comfortable with that whatsoever. There's so many times where I'm driving a modern car and it's happening in the Lexus I'm driving this week, and I'm looking to the side, or I'm looking ahead through the windshield at something to the side. Maybe it's a car that I'm worried about, like it's swerving or something, and I'm just trying to figure out if I'm going to pass it. Or maybe I'm trying to see a sign on the side of the road, and I get those warnings that says you're not paying attention. And it starts to disengage features. But the reality is I am paying attention. I'm just paying too much attention to something the car doesn't want me paying attention to.
Yeah, that's right.
With these mirrors, if I'm looking at the mirror, I don't want it to like misinterpret me looking at something as me wanting to change lanes. Like, that feels terrifying. It already
That's so demanding. Imagine like...
It already doesn't work well. And now you're adding directional changes to the mix.
Right. That sounds like the wrong way to approach. I mean, I understand. No, I don't. I was thinking like I can get the idea of it maybe like asking you about it. I don't know.
I mean, it is, I guess, asking, but there's multiple ways to answer that are
useful,
very
right.
You're committing to something.
I don't need the car to ask me to do something when I want to do something. I will do that thing when I want to do that thing.
We have turn signals, right? We can
That's the point.
The version that I used, you could activate the turn signal and it would change lanes. I didn't have to do that. It's not super smooth. The lane change itself is fine, but I find that the system has a tendency to go way over to the left and then correct itself. When I personally change lanes, it's a much smoother and more subtle action. I don't just like yank the wheel over. Okay. I think it might be because the BMW wants to make the change as quickly as possible. It doesn't want to be in a liminal state between changing and not changing. So it feels it just feels different from how a human would drive.
Yeah.
But if it's going to be doing that when I'm looking at mirrors, that underscores the fact that I don't want that to happen.
Right, right. Okay. You had the air console in this thing, though?
Yeah, but I didn't use it.
Oh, come on now. How could you?
I don't have time in my life for gaming.
You charged the car. What did you do while you were sitting there charging it?
I went to
it?
Barnes & Noble and bought some books.
Okay, fine.
And then the other time, I just sat in it like a sucker.
I love that you got so honest with me there. Okay, fine. sat there staring out.
What I mean is, I used to game a lot, and it took over my life, and it was all I would do. And I can't go back to that, and I haven't found a way to just do that. And the other thing is, these days, I only really want to play good racing games.
Okay.
And I only have a PlayStation 3. So I'd have to get a new console, essentially, to play new racing games. And that feels like a huge expense to just do this one thing. I'm trying to stop myself from doing too much, you know? Yeah. I don't know. It's a weird conversation in my head. During the height of the pandemic, I, of course, like everyone else in the world, tried to get a PS5, and it was impossible. And I feel like that kind of turned me off of the idea. So now I'm waiting for, like, PS7 or something.
Right. I love that. That's a great story. Thank you for walking us through your life experiences.
It's a tortured labyrinth.
Yeah, it is. but you know, that's reality for you. It's okay if you were to play any of the games on the Air console. I don't think you'd get addicted in any way or form. But
you're really
I don't know you. I don't know you.
Let me guess.
Well.
It's like a variation of Tetris and a variation of Snake and a variation of Angry Birds.
Yeah, it's basically a Nokia 8810
and like
or whatever.
Candy Crush. Only play games that are programmed by BMW?
I don't know. I don't think there's a store.
You didn't do it?
No, I didn't.
Wait, are you hassling me for not doing it, and then you didn't
do it?
I did
play on. There was a bunch of games that seemed to be already in the system.
And you played them?
I played them.
Okay, all right. Okay. But you didn't try to like code your own game.
No, I had things to do that day.
Oh, now you're the
I wasn't driving. I wasn't driving an electric car and sitting to wait for it to charge at 65 kilowatts.
Now you're the one with things to do. I understand.
That's
how it
right.
Works.
Now you do.
I'm childless. Nothing but endless rafts of time laying out before me.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So you've come to appreciate the gimmicks in this car.
No.
Did you get to?
I've come to learn where they are and then avoid them.
But at least it doesn't have a ginormous 50-inch screen.
Of course. 50 inches. My goodness.
Well, I don't know. Whatever the hyperscreen is.
Can you imagine? My TV's not even 50 inches.
That's okay.
Thank you for what's the word?
Reassuring you.
Yeah, reassuring me that the size of my TV is fine.
It is fine. You don't have to go out there and get, you know, there's like 100 inches.
Validating. That's the word I was looking for. You validated
my TV. But they're not plasmas, and I know you. You need to have your plasma.
I do need to have my plasma. It's the real deal.
It is. Okay, what else do you want to tell me about this?
Smooth movement.
What else do you want? No, no more smooth movement. Turn it off.
No, not smooth.
What else do you want to tell me? Okay.
Smooth movement.
Great. What else do you want to tell me about this i5? Are you going to buy one?
Not at that price.
No, of course not.
I think it's a good luxury buy. I'm not super enthused by the range. I feel like people are going to cross shop it against vehicles like Tesla, and they're going to look at that range and they're going to be like, I can get like, what, 400 miles from some versions of the Model S?
Yes.
I don't think the Model
S... Model S is like 12 years old now.
It is a considerably older
car. Like, style-wise.
Car. The dynamics are not the same. The interior is not the same. And the build quality certainly isn't the same. So you really have to ask yourself what's important when you're buying an electric car and then make your decision according to that. It's hard to make
prioritize. Prioritize what you've got.
You can't really make a blanket decision. Audi makes a compelling electric car that's a lot more expensive than this. The Mercedes-Benz is something I think I would avoid just because it's so bland outside of the AMG, and even the AMG isn't that compelling. The Genesis G80 electric
is an
interesting competitor to this car.
It's less powerful, significantly less powerful.
Less powerful, but you get very much the same kind of real car experience that the i5 offers.
And it's got great range, I think.
And it looks fantastic. And it charges much faster. It's like, this is a 205 kilowatt max. I think it's, what, 350 in the ideal conditions for the G80. So something.
An entry-level Taycan is $99,000.
That's $13,000 more than the i5 M60.
But it's a Taycan.
I don't know what that means.
That's true. Actually, this is slower in several ways. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. I'm very eager to try it myself because I think we've had this discussion before, but I think that of the established, or whatever you want to call it, quote unquote, legacy automakers,
I don't like that term.
BMW's transition into the electric powertrains has been very, not just like smooth, it's been very good. I think each one of the EVs that BMW offers these days is compelling.
Yeah, they took it more seriously than any of their competitors. That's the bottom line.
And they did it without like making a, I mean, they have a ton of gimmicks in their cars, but they didn't make their EVs the gimmick, right?
So BMW is pretty much the last independent automaker out there of any size. And they can't afford to make mistakes. Remember when we used to talk about how Subaru was so risk averse because they're so small and they couldn't, you know, take the chance of coming up with a product that nobody wanted. Yeah. And then you look at a company like Mazda that is in a similar situation and yet but seems, seems dedicated to making that those product decisions. And I think BMW sees this and they're like, look, we started on our electric vehicles 15 years ago, I guess.
Yeah.
And they've just been continually refining their product since then. And as you mentioned, they didn't break them out into...
They tried. I think the i3 and the i8 were gimmicky EV.
But those were part of Project I, which was the original research project designed to see what they could sell, what people would buy, and what was practical.
And what did they learn? That nobody would buy an i8 and the i3 people wanted more range out of.
They took risks with those cars, and it was okay to take risks with them because they didn't need to sell very many of them. And right. It was like, you know, it was essentially kind of like research and development. And now they're past that, and they're able, like you said, they learned that if they made these kind of weird cars, people weren't into it.
I'm into the i8, and I think you're into the i3.
Sure, but we're really not the kind of people.
We're weirdos, I guess.
Yeah, we're super weirdos. So Mercedes came at this the other way. They're like, well, we're going to make our dedicated electrics so different from our gas cars, because maybe that's what people want. They want to be reminded that it's an electric. And BMW realized that people just want a car that's a good car. And they're going to keep building good cars and better cars. And some of those are going to be electric. And that's
because I still have such good memories of driving the iX. And there's nothing like super standout, I think, about the iX. But it's good. Like it is a very complete package for an electric car. And I think the i4 feels the same way. I think this i5 sounds like the same thing. Complete vehicles, right?
And it's nice to have a company that is cohesive in this way. It's not a scattershot approach. Hyundai is another company, I think, that is doing a very similar thing. They're not doing the same type of platform merging. Like they either have dedicated or they have conversions, but they're not, I would say they're not relying on making their cars outliers. And I know they have set up, you know, the Ioniq and the EV for Kia as their own product lines. But right. I feel like it's different from Mercedes because if you look at the EQs for Mercedes-Benz, they all look the same. They all have that aerodynamic bar of soap look. If you look at Kia and Hyundai, they're actually designing cars. You know, they're making cars to go on the platforms. It's not every electric vehicle has to be this kind of super slippery shape. So they're approaching it in a similar fashion where they're trying to meet customers where customers are instead of trying to tell customers what they want. And that's been successful for them.
It's been impressive. I think we're going to start to see more automakers like see what's happening around them, what automakers are successful in terms of their EV approach. And I think we're going to start to see more people taking this BMW and this Hyundai approach to EVs. That's what I'd like to believe. That's what the ideal, the idyllic Sammy or the naive Sammy foresees. But you never know. Sometimes, you know, Mazda will come in here and decide that rotary, whatever gas extenders for their EVs are what people want, or whatever the power shot is in these Dodge Charger and Challenger EVs.
So, speaking of the idyllic naive Sammy, drove a couple of vehicles that are neither of those things this week. They're kind
idyllic
of...
idyllic or naive?
Yeah, they're kind of like just below the ideal, or I don't know how you would describe them.
I would describe them as being ultra mainstream, yet very important. This is because there are three-row crossovers. I'm talking about three-row crossovers this week, mainly because I'm you know, as a new dad, I'm constantly struggling to find more space for things in my car because I have a baby and a stroller and a partner and all of the stuff that goes with all those things and people. And I also always drive around with a ginormous stuffed monkey that I won from the fair back when I was 18. So I need all of this stuff in my car. And it turns out sometimes some vehicles don't have enough space for all of that. And whenever I talk about three-row crossovers to anybody, and I do that a lot, you know that.
Just at the bus stop or in the grocery store.
Yeah, like, you know what's great?
Waiting for the bailiff.
Yes. One of the first cars that come into conversation is the Toyota Highlander, which always catches me off guard because as I've been doing this job for over 10 years, I've driven a number of different versions and variations and generations of the Toyota Highlander, and none of them have ever particularly stood out in a meaningful way. I've always found them to be, yeah, that was pretty good. Let me take a look at the price here. Too expensive.
Like, I would argue that is precisely the point of the Highlander. I feel like the Highlander was designed to be a vehicle that does everything you just said it did.
Okay.
It was like, okay, it's good. Try not to think too hard about it.
So, obviously, you know, I had a conversation with my neighbor. He's got a RAV4 non-hybrid, and he's like, hey, he's got a dog, he's got a baby like me, he's like, I think maybe it's time for me to upgrade my ride. I want something a little bit more space. I'm leaning towards the Highlander. And my first impression is that I need to show him the Highlander, because I actually believe that there are other three rows that are more spacious, more affordable, they have better performance, and they have, you know, better design.
But they don't have that RAV4 to Highlander pipeline.
Yeah, I guess so.
Which is so important. No, I'm not even joking. I feel like that is the secret weapon of the Highlander. It's that the RAV4 is so ubiquitous.
Yeah, it's one of the best-selling cars in the world.
And
yeah.
It's good, you know, like for what it is, it's good. You can't knock it. And so everyone just extrapolates that experience to a larger vehicle. And they're like, well, if the RAV4 is good, the Highlander will just be good, but bigger, you know?
All right. So I'm going to tell you, my concerns with the RAV4 still, like, they persist after driving this vehicle. Now, I drove the hybrid version, and that is to me, if you're going to buy a Highlander, you have to get the hybrid. There's no point in getting, even though they have a new powertrain for the gas model, which is a 2.4 turbo 4, which is pretty good. The hybrid is still the main reason you should get a Highlander.
Why is that?
It's super efficient. I mean, we're talking really strong fuel efficiency numbers.
Real world, maybe, too, not just on paper.
Yeah. I'm thinking I would describe it as being compact car-esque.
What?
Yeah, like 36 miles per gallon for my three-row crossover.
That's pretty good. I mean, our base model Crosstrek gets 29.
Right.
And it is conservatively a third the size.
Exactly. And it feels pretty good. 243 horsepower. Doesn't sound like a lot, but it's very responsive. I did have some issues. I think the ECVT is very eager to ramp up the RPMs on the gas side of this powertrain, which is a 2.5 liter four cylinder.
ECVT sounds like four letters that are just going to depress me. It was like they had a letter. They had three letters I already don't like. And then they're like, but wait, there's more.
But the good news about this is because it's a hybrid, it can, once it reaches the speed or the acceleration that you're gunning for, it like can shut that thing down right away and let you coast, right? And I think that's instead of being really loud and noisy and buzzy like other vehicles with the CVT, which I'll talk about in a moment, it hits the power, it hits the speed that you're going for, and then just stops. That's what you needed, right? And it gets quiet again, and I think that's pretty good. One of the major issues I have with the Highlander, though, is packaging is kind of rough. I drove a mid-trim XLE model with the nightshade package. What that means is it looks slightly different than other Highlanders because it has blacked out handles, door mirrors, badges, and wheels.
Okay.
What color? And I'll tell you, driving a gray car with black door handles and black mirrors just looks strange. Like, it doesn't look right. But I'm missing a couple of features that I thought would be useful. Like, really, for example, rear heated seats are missing in this vehicle.
I never sit in the second row. I mean,
I know you never sit in the second row of the car that you own
your
or
child
drive.
Is in a child seat.
Yeah.
So but it doesn't affect them.
Okay. I also had a smaller infotainment screen. There's an 8-inch unit, which feels really, really small in comparison to other offerings around the industry. I mean, Subaru either gives you, I think, 2 7-inch screens or an 11.6-inch screen. So you've got lots of more screen real estate. It's easier to identify what's going on in the infotainment system. But the good news is the vehicle has rear sunshades. It has a wireless phone charger. It has wireless Android Auto and Apple CarPlay. So it has most of those features that work pretty good. And then that's it. I mean, this car costs about $45,000, which is a little bit above what I would describe as like an average price for a three-row crossover.
That's U.S. pricing, right?
Yes, that's U.S. pricing. You can get a gas-powered model for as little as $39,000. And again, I just would tell people to, if you're going to go for the Highlander, you might as well get the hybrid. You need to spend extra on that powertrain.
It's about like 18% more to get the hybrid.
Yeah. And you're getting what it's good for, right? Like the hybrid powertrain. And there are very few vehicles in this that are direct competitors to the Highlander that offer that blend of Toyota-ish. Which is like to say that you've got this expected reliability, this expected resale value, and that pipeline from something mainstream to something still mainstream, but bigger. The other vehicles that offer a hybrid in this class are the new Santa Fe. I think that's considered to be in the same class as this now. The CX-90 and the Ford Explorer, I think, is offered with a hybrid as well.
You don't think the Palisade is more of a Highlander thing?
Yeah, I don't know. But the new Santa Fe comes with, I think, is offered with a third row.
Okay. I haven't been in one yet, so I don't know how big it feels.
That really big, boxy, like, it looks like a Defender?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's weird, right?
It is weird.
The other three row that I drove, though, is one that has earned a really strong reputation from some consumer advocates, particularly Consumer Reports, for the second year in a row, has named Subaru as the best mainstream automaker, which blows my mind.
Is that based on what?
That's based on, I believe, perceived reliability.
Perceived reliability is the most marketing-drenched sentence or term I think you could pull out of the industry.
I believe they have surveys that pull it off. So they have a bunch of, I think they ask 100 people or something.
No, I understand. I just like the idea that there's perceived reliability and then there's actual reliability.
And then I think it also has their own rating scale for the performance and quality of the vehicle. So BMW, I think, was number one in their recent rankings, and Subaru was number two, which is pretty interesting because those are the cars that we're talking about this week.
By design.
I don't know. I drove the Subaru Ascent, which is a very... This is a bland car. Like, this is a very bland vehicle.
It's the Subaru Highlander, right?
It is the Subaru Highlander, but it is like $5,000 cheaper. It starts at $35,000-ish. And
no hybrid.
Comes with standard all-wheel drive, which I don't think is a given in the Highlander world.
So it's like $4,000 less than a base front-wheel drive Highlander.
Let me double check this powertrain here. On the base Highlander. Yeah, no, you need to spend an extra like $2,000 to get an all-wheel drive.
So it's Highlander. A bargain. But you're telling
it's
me
it's a bargain.
But you're
exactly.
telling me it's no good.
I'm not telling you it's no good. There is one reason to get this vehicle. It's to stay under budget, I think, is the main reason.
What
to
about
get it.
Safety? Doesn't it have a top safety pick status from the IIHS?
Everything has a top safety.
That
the Highlander has
true.
A top safety pick rating.
Top safety pick plus? That is not a long
No,
list.
It's not top safety pick plus.
Okay, that's what the Ascent is.
The Ascent has top safety pick plus. And we went through this, and that the major differences is that the IIHS has an updated front overlap and side crash test, where the Highlander performed one notch below the Ascent. Okay?
Yes.
Okay. Other things to point out about the Ascent is that it it seems to come with all of those features that I mentioned at fairly low trim levels. I'm talking, you get heated seats and heated steering wheel, heated seats in the back. You got a big old, I think, panoramic sunroof at some middling trim levels, which I think is important. The packaging and the value in this vehicle are what sells it. And again, so that you can stay on or under budget and you can spend money on other things that matter in your life. And I think that's fair.
Other things that matter in your life.
The powertrain, cars aren't everything, are they?
PlayStation 7.
Yeah, the PlayStation 7 that you're talking about. The things that stand out as being kind of average or maybe subpar, the powertrain is just the turbo 4 that's found elsewhere in the Subaru lineup. It's got this CVT that is really noisy, and it's not the most fuel efficient vehicle.
What's the penalty versus the Highlander that you drove?
Well, I drove the Highlander Hybrid.
Yeah, with a $10,000 price gap.
Yes.
Okay.
So you're talking a 22 mile per gallon Subaru Ascent versus a 36 mile per gallon Toyota Highlander Hybrid.
22 miles per gallon.
Yeah, it's not good.
Combined is not a good number.
Yeah, not good.
Like that CX-90 that I drove had substantial power, more power than the Ascent. And I think
I
think it was like 30 miles per gallon or something. Yeah. I saw out of that.
Was that the Turbo 6, wasn't it?
The Turbo 6, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't fast, but it was definitely frugal.
Mm-hmm.
So, uh-oh.
Yeah, exactly.
So is it worth it, though? Is it worth, like, paying less money and then paying more money over time? Is that kind of the gist of this? Do you get more features? Is there anything?
You do get a ton of features. I mean, like I mentioned, not more features than the Highlander, because I think many of the same features are available between the two cars, just depending on the trim level of the Highlander that you get. But you get them a little bit cheaper and easier in the trim walk.
I know that's what you're all about.
In the Subaru. Look, we have to be blunt, though. Like, you and I have recommended the Telluride, the Kia Telluride and the Hyundai Palisade for, it's got to be over 2 years now, right?
Sure, yeah.
3 years, maybe?
Maybe more.
And those cars also have their downsides, especially in fuel efficiency. Their V6 isn't the most fuel efficient on the market.
But
and
you get power to go with that, right? Like, with the Subaru, yes. You're not getting blown away by the power. It's fine.
It's fine.
Yeah.
But they're, I mean, Kia and Hyundai have had a reputation of being kind of not unreliable, but, you know, not great in terms of reliability. And there was that whole debacle with the Kia boys. Not that I think it affects the Palisade in any way or the Telluride.
You're saying they're not looking for the Palisade? And
no, I do think that people steal the Highlander in high numbers. Or is that just because it's a very popular crossover?
No, I think you're right. I mean, it might be both, but I think you're right.
So I'm just going through these three row crossovers and trying to figure out what is actually the best. And is there anything still like that tops the Telluride or Palisade? And to me, the Highlander Hybrid gets close. It just goes above the bare minimum. It's more refined than the Ascent. It has that hybrid powertrain, which is excellent in this class. And like I said, it has the perceived resale value and expected resale value and reliability that you expect. But if none of those things matter, if maybe you're owning a car for a short period of time, or you don't really, you know, or you want to live it, you want to drive it for the rest of its life, I think that Subaru is cheaper in the long run. I don't know. Right? A cheap Subaru up front that lasts longer or lasts just as long as a Toyota, it can do the job.
So, if you yes. want to tell us
yeah. how we why
can,
I'm wrong,
how we can do our job when this isn't even a job that we're doing.
Oh, by the way, I'm going to be getting a Honda Pilot in a few weeks. So this three row discussion will continue then.
If you are not yet tired of three row discussion, if you are even contemplating adding a fourth row to the lineup and you want to talk to us about it, how could they do that, Sammy?
They can go to our website, unnamedautomotivepodcast.com. And while they're there, there's a contact form. You hit contact us or, you know, contact and you fill it out. It lands in our inbox and you've essentially gotten in touch with us. It's great. Additionally, you can reach out to us the old fashioned way. Email us at benjamin@benjaminhunting.com, or you can reach out to us on social media Ben is on the filter-filled world of Instagram. Do people actually still use filters on Instagram? That's my biggest
curiosity. I've never used one.
I know you've never used
one. I edit them before I post them.
Yeah, okay.
I want it to be, I want the workflow to be as clunky as possible. I export the photos from my phone to my Atari. I do an 8-bit render, which is hard because that's not an 8-bit machine.
That's right.
I have two of them working together in tandem.
Yes.
And then I bring it back to my phone. My phone is overheating by this point. I let my phone cool off, then I post it. It's been a couple days, photos no longer relevant.
Right. You can find him on Instagram. He's at Hunting Benjamin. Or you can find me on the hate-filled world of X. I'm at Sammy_ha, hiding from all of the trolls. That's really what I'm doing. What else can we tell people? Go to our website, unnamedautomotivepodcast.com. You'll find all of our previous episodes. There are over 350 of them.
And give us a little rating. Subscribe to us, leave a little review. All that stuff helps. It helps
give us a little love. Come on.
It helps expand the Unnamed Automotive Podcast listenership. And that's cool because then we hear even more from you and we love that. Sammy,
we certainly do.
You talked about the pilot, but what are you going to be talking about next week specifically?
I'm getting my hands on the Toyota Prius again. Is that okay?
Not really. So we're probably going to put you
skip
on
that.
Yeah, we might skip that.
Ben. There are so many new cool cars that I want to talk about, specifically some EVs that have just breaking into the world, and I can't wait to tell you about them next week.
I'm going to be talking about the Lexus TX, which is the Lexus version of the Grand Highlander, and it's the first kind of legitimate three-row they've had. We all remember the abomination that was the RXL. RIP RXL.
What about the LX, the Land Cruiser?
Yeah, I guess that's true. But that had seats that folded down from the walls, which was not the best. It was not the best setup.
Did it have a liftgate or a swing tailgate? I can't remember.
I don't remember. But if you're on Safari, maybe this is what you're going to pick so you can get out and do whatever it is you do on Safari. But if you're just going to school, it's a little rough. I'm going to be talking about the TX next week.
Very cool. I should talk about that Grand Highlander in context of the Highlander.
Sure.
It's bigger. It's bigger than the Highlander. So
more three rows, more wins. We did talk about the Grand Highlander back in December.
Okay. So go back to that episode.
Yeah. That's probably better than hearing it again.
All right. See you later, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.